Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, views and reviews from the ground up. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host this morning. Today on our show, we look at women's lives through a couple of cultural lenses. Book Mole Fran Michel reviews a British feminist novel from the 1940s, and Movie Moles Jan Hocken and Denise Morris offer up their take on the film Tar, about a woman composer and conductor. To begin our show, we turn to the ongoing crisis of immigration. Bill Resnick speaks with Larry Kleinman, co-founder of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, who currently works with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. They discuss the state of immigration in the U.S. today and what can be done to humanize immigration policy and promote a sustainable transformation of the worldwide economy in the face of climate crisis. Here's Bill and Larry.
Hi, Larry Kleinman. Welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be here, Bill. Thanks for inviting me.
Larry Kleinman co-founded with Cipriano Ferrell, Ramon Ramirez, and others the organization PICUN.
Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, in Spanish.
So Larry, Bill Clinton, George Bush Jr., Obama, Trump with his wall, now Biden, all of them have enlarged the Border Patrol and the rest of the border protection apparatus. But all, including Trump with all of his cruelties, failed to stop the flood of people crossing the border. In fact, over the last couple of years, it amazed me, over 1 million non-citizens crossed the border and settled all over this country. So first, Larry, tell us how and why this very surprising and completely unintended development came to happen.
Yeah, your introduction of all this really poses in sharp relief the fact that immigration and migration is a fact of life in this world, and the United States, for all of its power, is no exception. That it's risen and fallen over the periods you described, but increasingly, as we all read in the media, has had a higher flow. And I believe that's largely driven by climate change, directly and indirectly. One thing that is really remarkable about the last few years compared with other times is that this flow of people previously would seek to enter through whatever legal channels. That's always been true. They're very limited. That's something that American public really doesn't understand how limited they are, but otherwise would somehow try to enter surreptitiously, usually through the help of a human smuggler, right? That still continues. But in the last few years, we've seen millions of people come to the border, cross over either at the Rio Grande or on a land border, and look for Border Patrol agents to surrender themselves and apply for asylum. And that triggers a different process. There is no capacity to detain all of those folks. We saw the different cages and the military bases and other things that especially the Trump administration attempted to employ, but they quickly were overflowing. And so the reason why there is over a million folks who are now around the country, having been processed by Border Patrol and released into the population pending their political asylum hearing, is that the simple lack of capacity and maybe the lack of will, and maybe that's a good thing, I gotta say, but it's the lack of will to actually affect some other kind of control at the border. Now, I want to go back to what I said a minute ago. Climate change is the meta driver in this. And to understand the sheer will and risk-taking of folks who come here, I want to offer a statistic to you, Bill, that I just read yesterday. In the last year, 250,000 people traversed the Darien Gap on foot. And this is a roadless area. It's about 75 miles long between Colombia and Panama, one of the most dangerous terrains in the world, jungle and controlled by criminal gangs more recently. 250,000 people traversed that on foot. Now, one has to imagine a level of desperation, and that's also just to say that's thousands of miles from the U.S. border. So those folks then have to continue on through a number of countries just to get to the southern border of the United States. And many of those folks have traveled through many other countries to get to that geographic area. To me, that says everything we need to know about how desperate folks are. And when we unpack why they're desperate, what we find is the effects directly and indirectly of climate change.
Well, let's be more specific. Many of the peasants in Latin America have been displaced by the local powers, either the army or agribusiness, and put on land that's less productive. And climate change, because of the droughts and the heat, lower production to the point where people cannot make a living. And so a lot of the people are peasants who just set off and try and save up a little money and set off on foot for a place where they can work for sufficient funds to stay alive, them and their families. And there were many, many, many of the people who surrendered had kids, which really complicated the problem for Trump. And he played it really badly by caging them and dividing the families.
Exactly.
I don't think the Republicans will do that again. That really ruined them for a lot of people, including Republicans. Anyway, why don't you continue, Jerry?
So the syndrome you describe about the collapse of rural agrarian economies in key micro regions, the highlands of Guatemala, for example, where they grow coffee, is an absolute driver. The increased impacts of mega hurricanes in Central America, which themselves have weakened governments, which were already weak. And now there's a control by criminal gangs that are increasingly brutal and powerful. So you have countries really barely governable, like Honduras. And then on top of that, the effects of the pandemic. We've read a lot about Haitians coming to the border. And many of the folks coming to the border in recent times have not been coming directly from Haiti. They've been coming from other countries in which they had resettled, including, for example, Chile, where there was a considerable number of Haitians who resettled after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. But in the pandemic, found the economic circumstances there intolerable. The opportunities that they had disappeared. And so they were once again migrating to a place of safety. And so all these things have come together to create a flow that we've never seen before. And I'm, from my vantage point, I'm here to say that this is only the beginning of more of this that we're going to see. And so if our conclusion is that we struggle as a nation to deal with the politics that are triggered by this phenomenon, we certainly have the capacity to resettle this number of folks. In fact, we need labor. We can talk about that later. But if we can't deal with this level, we really need to think hard about and try to imagine what it's going to be like when the numbers double, which I believe they may well in a short number of years.
Before we leave this subject, Larry, let's go to what I consider an enormously humorous story of the Venezuelans who DeSantis picked up, not in Florida, but in Texas. He flew them to Charlotte, North Carolina, and then had another flight to Martha's Vineyard. Most of them were Venezuelans. And when they got to Martha's Vineyard and met all of these people who wanted to help, they said, yeah, help us. Get us to Florida. Get us to Florida, right, where we have relatives and have jobs waiting. No, it's really preposterous. DeSantis flew people all around the world in order to get to Florida. Yeah.
What puts a sadder and even more exquisite point or finer point on it is some of those same 50 folks that you're describing who ended up at the airport in Martha's Vineyard, didn't even know where they were, right? Ended up, when they finally got to Florida, ended up working in emergency cleanup jobs in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian.
So, Larry, this system is absurd, in fact, in so many ways, of course, and absurd because considering it satisfies no U.S. interest group except perhaps low-wage employers who are very happy with the stream of people who are desperate. But you see it lasting a long time, and it's not going to be replaced soon, regardless of who's in power, Republicans or Democrats. Tell us why.
Well, it's the same political deadlock that we've seen in demagoguery for many years. On so many issues, we see that the country is polarized and the sides are fairly evenly split in terms of voter demographics. So it's a deadlock not easily bridged. And the Republicans in particular are hyper invested in giving no accomplishment. I mean, obstructing every possible accomplishment they can for Biden and the Democrats, even to the point of overriding the interests and the lobby of a powerful group in their ranks, the growers. So agribusiness has been screaming to pass an immigration law that would regularize the status of 1.5 million farm workers or so, and create a better system for what's called future flows, workers coming in the future. We were part of those negotiations time back, and still are. Our Pecos president, Reyna Lopez, is still involved in that process that's ongoing. In any event, it's so that when workers come in the future, they don't simply come contracted for a period of time and only for one employer, but can switch employers and can eventually stay permanently. So that those are big concessions that we've been demanding for decades, and that's in that proposal. Well, interestingly, as powerful as we imagine the agribusiness lobby is, especially among the ranks of Republicans, in the lame duck session we just saw in December, they could not find or move 10 Republicans out of 50, including the 7 Republican senators who were retiring and didn't face political consequences in the future for any action they took. They could not find 10 to break an inevitable filibuster, to move a House bill that would have instituted these reforms for agriculture that had passed in the House twice, including first time 36 Republicans, the second time about 30 Republicans. So it had not inconsiderable Republican support in the House, passed overwhelmingly. And they couldn't even find 10 senators. And to me, that's a real testament to how deep the polarization and the xenophobia and the deny the Democrats any accomplishments by any means is the name of the game. And that's why we have little or no basis to expect that with a Republican House, a narrow majority in the House, a Democratic Senate, also narrow, that won't continue to exist. There is a means, by the way, in the House that they could move a bill without going through the Rules Committee, without going through the Speaker, even. It's called a discharge petition. If 218 members of the House sign a petition saying we want to vote, there has to be a vote within 30 days, unless the Republicans change that rule. They have not so far. It would require a handful of Republicans siding with all the Democrats to move a bill like that, for example. It would force a vote. There would obviously be repercussions against those individuals, and they'd have to think about that, the Republicans. But it's not going to happen, Bill, because everybody knows that there aren't going to be 10 votes in the Senate to break a filibuster there. So it would be a meaningless exercise.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman, co-founded PICUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union and Immigrants' Rights Organization. We've been discussing the how and why more undocumented immigrants are seeking to come to this country, and more are making it through untouched by eluding the Border Patrol or by surrendering to them, making claims for asylum, and getting scheduled for asylum hearings. These would be far into the future, but scheduling of the hearing allows them to stay in the U.S., which in turn allows them to hook up with relatives, friends, fellow country people, and get settled to get almost entirely low-wage work. Still, for the immigrants, getting settled and living stably with employment and family and often church supporters, that gives them a leg up in getting permanent status. So, Larry, while the current system could go on for a long time, regardless of who's in power, at some point the tensions will force some sort of resolution. What's your candidate for that point when something will have to be done?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd make three quick points about it. First is we're seeing a lot of people ask, well, if Congress isn't going to act, why can't the Biden administration use its executive authority? The most well-known example of that in recent times was the DACA program for youth that came to this country before the age of 16. That was an executive order issued by President Obama in 2012. But what we've seen in that realm and other sweeping executive measures is that right-wing attorneys general around the country from the states have filed litigation challenging those as unconstitutional power grabs by the executive of what they contend is legislative authority, meaning if Congress wants that to happen, they'll legislate it. If they don't, the executive branch cannot categorically extend employment authorization and deportation protection to hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So this is working its way through the courts. It's gone up and down. As we remember, Trump tried to cancel it. There was litigation by the Democratic attorneys general. But this is going to come to a head, and it's going to be, I think, a cataclysmic moment for the immigration issue because of all the attention paid to DACA in the last 10 plus years. Now, we'll see the decision in the Supreme Court of an important underlying case this term, this year, 2023. But I don't believe DACA will come to a head in the court until 2024 or possibly 25. But I'm 100% sure it's headed there. The lower courts are going to have ruled against the Obama administration, now the Biden administration. I don't think the Supreme Court majority is going to be receptive. And I think they're going to strike it down as too broad a use of executive authority. And then if our movement does our work, together with many, many institutional allies in business, in academia, in local government, in faith, in labor, in solidarity, in racial justice, we will foment a real cathartic moment as we are all witness to 25,000 young folks, many of them no longer that young, losing their status that they've had for upwards of 10 years every month for the succeeding 2 years as DACA sort of withers. And that's a political moment to try to break through the deadlock and the stonewalling of the Republicans. So it's my call to my counsel to immigrant rights leaders to prepare for that moment as mightily as possible. But the last thing I want to say about it is the larger challenge we have is what I call the fraught politics of welcome. We know millions of people are coming. We know why they're coming in many cases, or in most cases. Our legal system isn't really prepared to handle them, but our economic system badly needs them. We're an aging population. There is not an emerging workforce to care for us, the aged, or the increasingly aged, never mind in 10 years or 20 years. So the worker base of this country is declining, and we need an infusion of workers. So it's a good thing economically and demographically that this is happening. It's a bad thing that it's happening because of all the suffering that it occasions, and it's not well organized. But that, unfortunately, is going to continue. The folks who naturally would most acclaim and applaud this arrival and call for a generous and open welcome, they do that, but the political actors are cowed or afraid, and with some good reason, I think, of the reaction of the xenophobes and the white supremacists, who, of course, characterize this as an invasion of non-white folks who are going to only hasten the day that white folks become a minority in what they regard as a white entitlement or white supremacist claim to culture and government power. And so to sort of avoid that, otherwise pro-immigration actors are really undervoiced or silent about that welcome. And so as opposed to being full-throated and sort of engaging the debate fully, frontally, and attempting to persuade the American people that this is really both a fulfillment of American values, of refuge on the one hand, and a good thing economically in terms of jobs and the economy on the other.
I think that there's no doubt that when DACA comes down and ends the Dreamer's Dream, all of those folks, and with support from the movements, will gain a great audience. There'll be a great furor. My sense is that the kind of movement that you're discussing, that is the importance and, in fact, necessity of having more people in the workforce who are ready to work and at decent wages, that set of ideas is extremely important. And even if, in fact, it doesn't carry the day and somehow the Congress squeezes out some much lesser reform, trying to satisfy the Dreamers a little bit, whatever it is, some kind of compromise. But another crisis is coming up. It can't be estimated what year it will be, but the climate crisis is certainly on its way. People are already feeling it in many countries of the world. Here, the concern is growing and growing and growing. It seems to me when the crisis really starts in the United States, with food prices spiking, with areas of the country triaged so that the state and the country can no longer afford to repair the infrastructure that's getting destroyed by the huge storms or the great droughts that are on its way. And Phoenix is already now talking about forbidding any further growth. They're running out of water and don't know what to do. When it really strikes hard in the United States, my sense is that the corporate people are going to be angling to take control of the response, which would be a disaster. Their program is just a list of fantasy technologies and slow replacement of coal and oil. It will never work. The left program, though, does work. And my sense is that the left program would be an all-hands-on-board program to rebuild our economies and transform the energy system. Anyway, my sense is that the all-hands-on-board left program would contain not just a welcome, but incentives for rebuilding our industrial structure, which would take a huge number of workers, and rebuilding our transportation system and the rest of it. Anyway, we're out of time. I've been talking to Larry Kleinman, who co-founded Pecun, an enormously successful farm and worker protection group. We discussed why over 1 million people, mostly Hispanic, had crossed the border in recent years, even the Trump years, and settled in the U.S., and why that system is likely to last for a significant amount of time, but will ultimately fail in one or another national crisis. For me, it's the looming climate crisis, with both the left and our corporate friends now in struggle to determine who gets the authority and resources to plan and direct the response. If the left prevails, it'll be all hands on board across the world, in fact, with good jobs for all and into the future, if there is a future. Larry, you get the last word.
I appreciate that frame, and just say that part of that, I'm sure 90%+ of the folks coming to this, to our border now, really would rather stay home, right? As would we if we were in their position, but they can't. So part of our climate response is finding places in the world, first and foremost in their own countries, but nearby, if not, where they can achieve what you just described, a sustainable lifestyle. That's the more global kind of universal vision as well, that it's not simply immigration is the only response. So it's kind of yes and immigration and repair and adaptation in the sending localities.
Larry Kleinman, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
You just heard Bill Resnick and guest Larry Kleinman talking about U.S. immigration policy, followed by a clip from the song A Safe Place to Land by Sarah Bareilles. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The Corner That Held Them is a novel by British queer communist musicologist and writer Sylvia Townsend Warner, published in 1948. It's set mostly in a 14th century Benedictine convent between the Black Death of 1349 and the Peasants' Rebellion of 1381. Fran Michel discusses how the book's focus on the mundane material realities of a community of women helps to illuminate how a pandemic illness may contribute to the transformation from one mode of production to another.
In 2019, New York Review Books republished Sylvia Townsend Warner's 1948 novel, The Corner That Held Them. It's a beautiful, witty, and surprisingly timely read. The book opens in late 12th century Britain, on a scene of aristocratic, adulterous, post-coital lounging, violently interrupted by the arrival of the lady's husband. Years later, the aggrieved and grieving lord donates to the church one of the properties the lady had brought to the marriage, converting an old hunting lodge into a convent. Unfortunately, the location is lovely only during hunting season, and the buildings and grounds insalubrious much of the year. Nonetheless, the fictional convent of Oby persists through a series of mundane struggles, sometimes laconically recorded in the style of medieval annals. Quote, in 1223, lightning set fire to the granary. In 1257, the old reed and timber cloisters fell to bits in a gale. End quote. And so on. The nuns squabble and make do, for instance, by converting the old dovecot into a chapter house, although, quote, it made a very unpersuasive place of assembly. However, the arrangement was allowed as a temporary expedient, and as such, it became permanent. End quote. Such wry and elegant prose moves us quickly into the 14th century, where the narration settles for the rest of the book. The second chapter brings the arrival of Ralph Kello, a drunken vagrant with a religious education. Unaware that the pestilence has arrived at the convent, he stops there to ask for a meal and is mistaken for a monk because a bad case of ringworm has left his hair in the pattern of a tonsure. When the nuns tell him they're desperate for someone who can perform mass because their own priest has fled to another town, Ralph tells them, on impulse, that he is a priest, although in fact he is ineligible for priesthood because he was born illegitimate. But although Ralph remains at Oby, he's not the main character either. Warner herself once said of the book that, quote, it has no conversation and no pictures, it has no plot, and the characters are innumerable and insignificant, end quote. Certainly many of those characters are vividly drawn, as are many small dramas of daily life in a 14th century Benedictine convent. Yet unlike, for instance, Sigrid Undset's Kristin Lavransdatter trilogy, another fiction written in the early 20th century and set in the 14th, The Corner That Held Them does not offer a humanistic narrative guided by willful individual choices against a backdrop of historical context clarified for the bourgeois modern reader. Instead, it remains rooted in local perspectives while registering the impact of wider social forces, attending both to ideological idiosyncrasies and to relations of production and power. As Ralph thinks at one point, quote, causation tunnels like a mole under the surface of our free will, end quote. There's no evidence that Warner's mole reference alludes to Marx's figure of the subterranean forces of revolution, though it does resonate with Marx's observation that we make our own history, but we do not make it just as we would like. However, it's safe to assume that Warner knew those references. An active member of the Communist Party of Great Britain from the 1930s into the 1950s, she and her life partner, Valentine Ackland, worked on anti-fascist and Marxist projects, organizing and demonstrating against Oswald Mosley and other British fascists, campaigning on behalf of the British Medical Aid Committee supporting the Spanish Republicans, and traveling to Spain during the Civil War there. Warner's other novels also reflect her interest in the history of people's struggles for justice. Summer Will Show, published in 1936, is set during the French Revolution of 1848. After the Death of Don Juan, published in 1938, is inspired by the Spanish Civil War. Warner's first novel, Lolly Willows, published in 1926, is perhaps her best-known work. Although written before her formal involvement with left movements, it's nonetheless an anti-authoritarian book, a queer feminist fantasy about a middle-aged spinster who happily sells her soul to the devil and becomes a witch. Yet The Corner That Held Them seems especially right for our moment. Its resistance to conventional plot helps invite slow, immersive reading, a kind of antidote to the distraction induced by much of our contemporary life. Moreover, it's set mostly between the Black Death of 1349 and the Peasants' Rebellion of 1381, and the book illustrates the impact the pandemic had in empowering the surviving half of the working-age population of laborers. Throughout the text, the various prioresses at Oby worry about convent finances, and after the plague, they have trouble getting workers to fulfill their traditional obligations to bring in the convent's crops. But it's not all economics and plague. Partway through The Corner That Held Them, for instance, one character discovers the new music known as the Ars Nova, Latin for new art. Marked by the introduction of polyphony, that is, using multiple simultaneous but relatively independent melodic lines, as in counterpoint, and the experience unfolds for him a vision of freedom. This, he thinks, was paradise itself. This, quote, was how the blessed might sing. singing in a double measure that ran as nimbly on its 4 feet as a weasel running through a meadow, with each voice in turn enkindling the others, so that the music flowed on and was continually renewed. And as paradise is made for man, this music seemed made for man's singing, not for edification, or the working out of an argument, or the display of skill, but only for ease and pleasure, as in paradise, where the abolition of sin begets a pagan carelessness, where the certainty of Christ's countenance frees men's souls from the obligations of Christian behavior, the creaking counterpoint of God's law and man's obedience. End quote. In the corner that held them, the mole of socio-political change, tunneling under the surface of our individual free will, moves toward freedom not just through material struggle, but also through the ease and pleasure of art. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel, recommending The Corner That Held Them by Sylvia Townsend Warner.
Music you just heard was Audivi Vocem by 16th century composer Thomas Tallis and sung by New York Polyphony. Before that, Fran Michel reviewed the novel by Sylvia Townsend Warner, The Corner That Held Them. And now, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Denise Morris talk about the film Tar. As Jan and Denise discuss, the movie has attracted mixed reviews for taking up difficult and complicated questions of personal power and exploitation.
Good morning, Jan. It's really great to be back with you. It's been a very long time since we've done a Movie Mole.
Yeah, Movie Mole's in the ground coming up above to talk about this interesting movie.
I'm really happy to be back. We're talking about the film Tar, released in 2022. And Tar is a psychological drama directed by Todd Field, and it stars Cate Blanchett. The film charts the downfall of fictional composer and conductor Lydia Tarr. And this morning, Jan, we're here to take up the mixed reviews and reactions to the film, and particularly in its portrayal of sexual and class politics. We will offer our readings of Tarr as a morality play, plotting the fall of a highly ambitious and exploitative woman at the peak of her career.
Some critics view the film as problematic in its portrayal of women and the dynamics of abuse and power. One reviewer commented that Tar is a regressive film that takes bitter aim at so-called cancel culture and lampoons so-called identity politics, unquote. It's also interesting to look at the film, as we feminist critics often do, through the Bechdel test, the test that asks whether a film, number one, features at least two women. Two, do they talk to each other? And three, do they talk about something other than a man? And from this feminist critical perspective, it is about women's relationships. And I think the Bechdel test also asks us to look at the complexity and range of female characters rather than counting positive characters on the screen. So I think it is an interesting film about power dynamics and the sexual elements of hierarchical relationships, including between students and teachers and mentors and mentees.
And these are not easy conversations to have. There's a lot to mine on this film, and there's a wide audience out there that is really welcoming the challenge that this film has taken up to tackle these questions and do it in a way that, as Martin Scorsese said, was a high wire act, and to do it in such a way that, in my opinion, was interesting and compelling and good filmmaking. Of course, you can't miss with the performers who are in it, and Cate Blanchett and Nina Hoss They've got long history of taking on complicated female characters. And so for that reason, I think people are drawn to the film and wanting to take up its complexities and contradictions.
Yeah, I mean, you could place it in the tradition of femme fatales and the noir genre, where you have a powerful woman rising. You know, she's transgressing boundaries, and she has a kind of charismatic power, but malevolent in her motives. And at the end of many noir films, you see the female protagonist punished at the end as she meets her fall. And the film does punish this very aggressive, exploitative woman at the film's denouement. But I think in between, there are some very interesting questions about how we're to view her. She's not a virtuous person. She's very narcissistic and exploitive in her relationships with people. The film is almost entirely from her point of view. We kind of look at the world through her eyes, and scenes, almost every frame is from her point of view. Sometimes we see her image duplicated through various reflections, so we have this sense of different dimensions of her, but throughout she's very exploitive and also sexually exploitive of her students and people over whom she has power. So I think that dynamic is always a complicated one to take up for feminists. I mean, you could say, how does this compare to how men are portrayed, who are also ambitious? Are women more apt to be punished in films for an excess of narcissism or ambition? Does it matter that she's a woman, or is it really about power where her gender is not so relevant?
Early in the release of the film, there was a lot of confusion about who Lydia Tarr was, and many, including myself, confessed to Googling this person to figure out, is this a real person? Because the film has a particular nature to it that really seems like a biopic.
Yeah, I mean, it opens with her being interviewed on a stage by Adam Kopnik with The New Yorker, and he's playing himself, and it feels like a real interview with a composer.
And if you get into reading about the film before you see it, you're maybe expecting it to be about Me Too, or to be a message film, or to be a cancel culture film. And it's been called all of those things. But the filmmaker and the leading actors really hold to this idea that this is an exploration of power and the misuse of power and what happens when someone is so powerful inside a very particular world. There's a lot of conversations in the film that refer to other composers of the past who had their own falls at the peak of their careers when their misdeeds had come to light. So they're laying out a kind of landscape within this world in which power is wielded in very particular ways. It's a world in which wealth and power and prestige and status, those are the rules of the game.
There's been some discussion online and among reviewers about the one clear victim of Lydia Tarr, the lead's mentorship and sexual predations, this young woman who we only know as Krista Taylor, who is an aspiring, apparently talented young student composer who we never see. She's on the margins. We learn about her through conversations Lydia has with her assistant and concerns that arise. And as a spoiler alert, we learn she's committed suicide and that this prompts investigation on the part of her parents over a relationship with Lydia. And we learn that Lydia had mailed negative recommendations to institutes where Krista had applied. And basically, it ended this woman's career. Mm-hmm. And that this seems to be related to Krista pursuing her in a way where Lydia was done with her in a very cruel way. And we only learn about the relationship and try to piece it together through Lydia's conversation with her assistant. And we only know about her through Lydia's perspective as her abuser.
In terms of how we see the abuses take place in film and TV shows, there's lots of examples of programming that has tried to take up these questions around abuse of power within a workplace or in a situation in which someone can determine the course of your career. But there's some interesting writing about this film as having elements that are happening not necessarily in real time. I wouldn't say not in the real world, but Krista is in Tar's orbit in all of the ways that you mention. But she's also sort of a haunting figure, and film actually begins with a conversation via a texting chain between what we might guess is Francesca, Lydia Tarr's current assistant, and Krista. It seems the three of them have had a relationship. They talk about how she's haunted, and the response is, "Do you mean she has a conscience?" And the response is, "Maybe." So from the very beginning of the film, we're asked to question whether or not Lydia Tarr has a conscience and is she haunted. We do see Krista at the New Yorker event. We see her in front of a hotel, and I think she's brought in also more concretely through technology, as you mentioned, but also not just the technology of the emails, but through her correspondence with Francesca, who still has an ongoing relationship with Tarr. She's still Tarr's assistant. She still
has
aspirations.
Also an aspiring conductor. And
exactly,
so
yeah.
Lydia Tarr has this capacity to anoint or destroy people or mm-hmm. to treat them as underlings in her world. Yeah, I think that question of is she plagued by guilt or something else interested me as a psychologist who's interested in psychological portrayals, and this has been described as a psychological drama. I read her hauntings as more of a paranoia she developed. She's someone mm-hmm. very obsessive and invested in controlling everything within her reach, and a world that she inhabits that's subject to her control, and she sees others as kind of instrumental in some way, extensions of her own desires and not as having separate needs of their own. And I think there was an attempt to portray a narcissistic controlling person who begins to realize that many of the people they control have wills and desires and capacities to punish them in their mm-hmm. own right. So she mm-hmm. begins to see things on the periphery, and there is a kind of anxious paranoia of scrutinizing.
Things go missing, noises,
yeah.
She hears the scream. Some writers have suggested that we don't take this film literally. Some of the ways that Tarr is an exaggerated figure within the conducting world. She's a woman in that world. So few women conductors. What is the path that a female conductor would take to just be stoic, or someone like Lydia, who actually channels an enormous amount of passion and feeling to an extreme, and even almost, as some have noted, kind of comical, but for me, it's melodramatic. It's an exaggeration of something that is happening in her that she cannot channel outside of that world.
This is Denise Morris and Jan Hawken talking today about the film Tarr. There are several scenes that are quite riveting because they so much conform to actual classroom scenes or seminar scenes that many of us who've taught could relate to, mm-hmm. identifying with some of the criticisms students have of teachers and how you handle them. Do you want to talk about that Juilliard sequence?
It's a really amazing scene, and it resonates for people wide and far. It's a really interesting and important scene. It happens early in the film. And as you say, it's a learning environment with a person who is toxic, dealing with a young student, Max, who does an amazing job. The scene between the two of them, they were so good together, but what they draw out is the tensions around whether or not you're teaching students or you're trying to make your own point.
Yeah, this Juilliard sequence unfolds around her leading as a very prestigious conductor who's clearly intimidating the students, but she is meeting with student conductors, and one of the students who identifies as BIPOC and queer challenges her love of Bach. Mm-hmm. There is humility in Bach. He's not pretending he's certain about anything. It's always a question that involves the listener. It's never the answer. She argues that Bach has a lot to teach us as a musician about how to listen to music. And he's not buying it. He says Bach is one of these old white misogynist patriarchs, and his music does nothing for me. And I only want to listen to music that speaks to me as a BIPOC queer person. And so she's taking him on around that, and he says you can't separate the person from the music, and what his life was about kind of canceled him out for this student Max. And she tries to get the student to listen again and to separate the man and the music. And early on, I could identify with this, kind of pushing the student in good ways to challenge his assumptions. And how much do you rule out by those criteria? How much do you even know about these musicians? And when you can't listen to so much, what do you sacrifice as a composer? And then he pushes back against that, playing with him on the piano and trying to reach him on a different level. But then she gets very cruel, and she can't pull back.
She gets thwarted, and she digresses to find herself divulging her own demons when she says, you have to sublimate yourself. You have to stand before the public and God and obliterate yourself. You have to end who you are to be in this world.
Yeah, she refuses to be identified as a feminist or even a woman composer. And then in the other scene, she's defending women and knows a lot about women composers who have not been recognized historically. But I think that lack of empathy toward this student in that scene made it unfold in a way that felt to me grippingly real in terms of what can happen in a student-teacher relationship in the classroom when a student keeps challenging. And actually, it was the opposite. Her ego was totally involved in that scene, trying to force this resistive student to accept her point of view.
It's the kind of conversation that we're probably having everywhere and maybe don't have an answer for, but is how do we account for our loves of art made by people who are not perfect?
Who are actively exploitive and oppressive. Yeah.
Right. Tar, in that same scene, says now is the time to do work, conduct work that requires something of you. And I think that that is really compelling. What does it mean to take on something and to do something that requires something of you?
Yeah.
What are the times that we're in that provokes that kind of thinking on the part of someone who's successful, talented, and deeply flawed?
Yeah. I think we also come to read that scene against a late scene in the movie that is the basis for some criticism that it lampoons cancel culture. And we see later on students going after her and protesting against her at a book launch. We know, of course, they're right, that she has a history of sexual predation. But the case the students have put together, they stitched together in a way that completely misrepresents what went on in that classroom.
Right.
And they've created a video that isn't true to what we've come to see as what happened. So it does kind of poke at the Me Too movement and going after people without knowing how to make a case based on a careful knowledge of what the grievance is. And so I think when you have a scene like that, as the film does, you do understandably open it up to criticism that it is very dismissive of the reaction to her. The way that scene is cut together in a video, we understand it as really overly maligning her and misrepresenting what happened.
I mean, I don't disagree, but I think the way that technology is used in the film is, it's intentional, of course. I mean, Lydia thinks that she can just erase her emails about Krista and that they will just disappear into the ether.
So she has her own way of trying to control and falsify the past.
Right, yes, that's true. But she doesn't seem to understand the power of technology. It's almost like she's been so immersed in this other world. I mean, she's not that old, you know. It's like, come on, I'm older than she is. But, you know, technology can be used for the greater good and the greater harm. The idea that there's surveillance around our actions and our movements is very contemporary. And so the reason why these guys from the 19th century or whatever century didn't get their comeuppance is because they didn't go viral.
Before we end, I have to ask you about the place of motherhood and her role as a mother in this film, because often the mothering enters a story of a female protagonist either to condemn or to redeem her. And as her wife, Sharon, confronts her in a late scene, she charges that their daughter, they have a daughter together, she's the only person with whom your relationships are not transactional. She has a daughter with this woman, and in a way it does redeem her as a powerful woman who loves this child and is, by many measures, a good parent and protective and attached to this little girl. What's your take on the role of mothering in her character and in the story?
I think it's really interesting because it could be very problematic to consider her one non-transactional relationship to be with her child. But it does allow for us to see a certain kind of humanity in Lydia. But at the same time, we see her as a fierce protector of her child.
When she protects her daughter from a bullying at school,
she
describes herself as the father, as the protector in the outer world.
Lydia is a bully. So how
herself,
some might say, how rich, you know, the bully protecting her child from the bully.
Is the one being that's worthy of her protection, yeah.
Right. But I also had some questions about how she exists in that world. You know, Lydia, she has a separate apartment, and she's not going to give it up because it's her place. I mean, on the one hand, if she weren't philandering bully, it would be like, okay, so what? You've got your work apartment. But she has this other home where she has a wife and a child, and I wonder how that functions for Lydia. Many of us believe our homes and our relationships and our children provide us this kind of safe harbor from the ills of capitalist society.
Uh-huh.
But for Lydia, it seems like what happens inside that home is still work, and she doesn't seem to enjoy her time there or have the ability to really fulfill an intimate relationship with someone. And thus her partner, Sharon, says, your only non-transactional relationship is with your daughter.
Well, and I think we also see how that apartment provides her not only a room of her own, but a place where she can bring women in and do things that don't work in her domestic sphere with her family life.
Yeah. We know that Lydia's true love is her work.
Well, I think in conclusion, it's an interesting film worth seeing and discussing. And so much of the reaction to it registers many of the ambivalent feelings we hold toward powerful, ruthless women who we've come to love either as mentors in our own path of development. I mean, there are a lot of women who clearly have crushes on her and admire her, and as a mentor, the love of the work and the love of this person who leaves people under her very vulnerable to exploitation was a very interesting theme, and I think was handled in an unsettlingly subtle way.
I think we need more cinema that takes on these complicated, contradictory characters and subjects.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jan.
This is Jan Hawken and Denise Morris talking today about the film Tar, now available streaming.
That was Jacqueline Dupré playing Elgar's Cello Concerto, a piece of music featured in the film Tar. The music was preceded by a review of Tar by Jan Hawken and Denise Morris. That does it for our show this morning. My thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Denise Morris, and Fran Michel for their contributions, John Nelson for his editing assistance, and especially to our guest, Larry Kleinman. Our gratitude always goes out to the dedicated staff of KABU, your community radio station. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from the 99%. Thanks for listening. I'm going to leave you today with a little bit of David Crosby performing Woodstock by Joni Mitchell. May he rest in peace.
Well, I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, "Tell me, where are you going?" He told me, "Said I'm going down to Yester's farm, gonna join in a rock and roll band. Got to get back to the land, set my soul free. We are stars, we are ghosts, we are fears. To get ourselves back to the God.